Hi folks, before this week's episode, which is just Ben and myself talking about some of the best things in the world, a couple of quick things. This week, my play Vespertilio opens at the Vault Festival in Waterloo, running from Wednesday till Sunday, that's the 20th to the 24th at 7:30, with a matinee as well on Saturday the 23rd. Really great team working on it. The director is fantastic, Lucy Atkinson. Two beautiful, sensitive, wonderful actors, Joshua Oakes Rogers and Benedict Salter. And if you haven't been to the Vault Festival, it's an amazing creative hub of all sorts of things, from comedy to music to dance to theatre. And I would love you, as many of you as possible, to come see the show. You can book tickets if you just look up Vault Festival and my name, or if you know how to spell it, Vespertilio. That's the name of the play. We want to give a shout out as well to a couple of our Patreon supporters, to Daniel Grocott, who has increased his Patreon support with us. Thank you so much for that, Daniel. And also to new patron, that is Tracy Cullen. You are our 25th patron. Ben and I will tell you a little bit more about what that means going forward from next week. But thank you, Daniel and Tracy, and to everyone else who supports us on Patreon, which enables us to pay various subscriptions, and from next month onwards also hopefully for some fancy new recording digs. As ever, please give us a look out on Facebook, on Twitter at Worst Foot. Look at our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. Recommend us to a friend and drop us a nice little review, as a couple of you have done this week. Ratings and reviews on places like iTunes or wherever you listen to us really, really do help in terms of getting us out there. So I think that's it from me. I hope you're enjoying this slightly more spring-like weather if you're listening in the UK. I think I saw the sun this week. And seeing as we're feeling a little bit positive, Ben and I are going to be positive in this week's episode.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. Except this week, once again, we're going to celebrate the best of the best. And in a world that is beset with darkness, woe and blight, it is important to have a shaft of golden sunlight to make us all feel a little bit better about the world. I start dying while reading that.
Choked on your own optimism.
Right.
So it's 2019, Ben. Everything's dying. Including you.
Let's see if I can feel a little bit happy about it this time. In a world full of darkness, blight and horror, it's important to have a shaft of golden sunshine to bathe ourselves in and feel optimistic about tomorrow. So consider this podcast to be a cube of freshly roasted halloumi in a salad of gravel, broken glass and pine cones. Consider it to be a consolation goal that is a mazy run that defeats five defenders and arrows into the top corner from 30 yards when 10 goals down. Consider it to be that moment when you see an assassin pop up just as Donald Trump wanders down Central Avenue on his third presidential parade. And with me is... I completely forgot what I was going to say to you.
I think the relationship's become stale. Yeah. 100 plus episodes in.
Oh no,
run out of compliments.
No, not at all. And with me is the warm fire in the desolate Highland cottage of my soul. Barry McStay.
We're recording this on what feels like the first day of spring. Like it's mid-February, but it's properly sunny outside now.
It is. It's absolutely delightful. I smelled blossom yesterday.
Yeah, and Ben, we're both wearing short-sleeved shirts.
Yes, we are.
Feels optimistic as well.
The problem is, and this defines everything about this podcast and the way the world is generally, so yesterday I was like, oh, it's unseasonably warm. It's springtime. It's beautiful. Hang on. Unseasonably.
Yeah, it's a trap.
It's definitely a trap. It's good old climate change.
But no, it's nice. We're recording in Bex and Beth's shed again. We've got lovely big windows. We can see the sunshine outside, but we're huddled around the microphone to try and go back to episode 16 to 20.
Yes.
This time, where we talked about the world's worst conspiracy theory, worst haircut, teen movie, Parasite, and wine. So that's a hell of a buffet.
Yeah.
Today after Valentine's Day, it feels like.
I'm pretty certain that those are the five opening chapters of the Trump biography.
I think you're pretty right, actually. Yeah, Conspiracy Theory, Haircut, yeah, teen movie, Parasite. Well, I think you're back, apart from the wine, because he's a non-drinker.
Oh, God, he is, isn't he?
Yeah, more's the pity.
Who is it? I saw a stand-up do a bit about him being a non-drinker and was thinking...
Yeah, Diet Coke.
Yeah, just imagine how nuts he would be if he actually drank alcohol.
Might calm him down, actually.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I can hardly imagine him, you know, snuggling down on a White House sofa with a nice glass of Merlot.
I can't imagine him snuggling, full stop.
He's not a natural snuggler.
He doesn't know. Not a snuggler.
No, he's a foister.
Rightio.
Yeah, let's get down to it. So you're going to go first, I think, on this. So our world's worst conspiracy theory was...
Saddam Hussein's Stargate. Yeah, in our episode with Jim Campbell, we discovered that the reason America really invaded Iraq.
Yeah,
happy days those.
Oh yeah, this is one of those episodes where like the worst was the best as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a terrific story.
Just a giant army of alien scorpions, I think.
Yeah, he did.
The planet Nibiru was involved.
Of course, it was. I found a conspiracy theory that some people thought that rocks were actually soft.
Yeah, great episode. Happy days.
What is you found for the world's best conspiracy theory?
I have a sort of a genre of favourite conspiracy theory, which is that certain geographical areas don't exist.
Love it!
It's so good. I think maybe we mentioned it in the original episode, that there is a theory that Finland isn't real. That Finland is actually just a sea area. There's no Finland there. The area of sea there is rich in fish, and Japan have fishing rights there. And so... They have basically the whole basis of this conspiracy is that Japan and Russia had suspiciously good relationships even during the Cold War and into the modern day, despite the fact they'd been at war with each other over 100 years ago. And basically, there's a theory that Japan can fish there unregulated, as opposed to the rest of the world where we wang on about how they do whaling and things like that, and that they give a proportion of the fish to Russia to fish in their waters, and that's the real reason the Trans-Siberian Railway was built, to enable the transport of all those fish across the continent. Some of the other bits of evidence for this are that Nokia sells surprisingly well in Japan, despite it being a supposedly Finnish company.
And the weirdest thing about Nokia is that Nokia was originally a logging company.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And my other favourite thing is that they go, Finland's high placing in country ratings to do with like happiness and GDP and all of that sort of stuff is too high for a real country, and it must just be that the rest of the world has gone, let's just create this ideal of a country that we can all aspire to.
So it's basically some cynics looking at Finland and going, no one's that happy.
No one is that happy.
But then
it's too cold there to be that happy.
I mean, the only Finns that I have to go on are Mika Häkkinen and
Kimi Räikkönen
and Jari Litmanen,
yeah. All excellent sporting people, but they're originally Swedish, according to this theory. They do say that, you know, Finland is 99% forest, so it's very easy to pretend a country doesn't exist when there aren't any people living in it, only, like, bears.
What I'd love it is if Moomins were real, but Finland wasn't.
Yeah.
And there were just loads of these tiny little white rounded creatures floating in nothingness, just picking fish out the ocean and handing them to passing Japanese tugboats. Yeah.
I mean, like the Oompa Loompas. They're like a slave race.
Yes! Kind of like in the Finnish confectionery warehouses, just full of really sad Moomins singing.
There's the reboot the nation is crying out for.
Yeah, with Kimi Räikkönen as Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka. There's also a theory that Wyoming doesn't exist, which was a joke that began in a Garfield episode. In Italy, they joke that Molise, which is their second smallest region in the country, doesn't exist. And in Australia, or there is a theory that Australia doesn't exist as well, despite the fact it's the sixth largest country in the world, but rather that Britain just wanted to execute 162,000 convicts and pretended they were just shipping them to a far-off country. When you get flown to Australia, pilots just fly you around for a bit and land you on another island full of actors.
Well, I mean, having grown up watching Neighbours and Home and Away, Australia is an island full of actors. I mean, and also, that conspiracy theory is plausible, that the British Empire was so evil that they would just send loads of ships with prisoners out and then sink them.
Chuck them in the Marianas Trench.
Yeah. I was going to say, when was it? A few months ago, me and my wife went to Vienna. And one of the greatest places I've ever been to is the Library of the University of Vienna. Imagine the most beautiful wood-panelled library of your mind, and it's like that. And they had these four enormous globes, two of them of the constellations in the sky and two of them of the known world. And
nice.
They're from about the late 1600s. And it's great because you look and go, right, there's Europe and the Middle East and Asia and India and Indonesia. And then what's that shape? Probably Australia. It's really nice seeing early modern cartographers going, there's something there.
We know. For sure. Or in the case of, like, conspiracy theorists, cartographers, like, nothing, and nothing up where Finland is, and it's just a hole in the middle of America.
And the globe is actually donut-shaped.
Yeah.
And in the middle of it, it's just full of lizards.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And my favourite one of these is there's a region of Acre in Brazil, which is sort of, it's a border region, so it borders, I think, Bolivia and Peru, so it's very far inland, and again, in Brazil, they joke that it doesn't really exist, it's not real. The other theory about it is either it doesn't exist, or it's actually a lost world full of dinosaurs.
Right.
I know which of them I prefer it to be. But yeah, so geographical country regions that don't exist are my favourite.
That's brilliant. Yeah. I looked up, I don't know if you know about this, it's less a conspiracy theory, more of an old Irish folk tale about something called Brazil, but with an S, which is an island.
Yeah. Hi Brazil, yeah. It's where St. Brendan the Navigator went to try and sail to. So there's a theory that an Irish monk, Brendan, sailed with some monks on a very small boat across the Atlantic before the Vikings are meant to have done it, before the Chinese are meant to have done it, before any of the European explorers did, in search of a land called High Brazil.
Oh, yeah. I like Brendan the Navigator as a name. That, I can't decide if that's a blues musician or a professional wrestler.
Yeah. It was early sat-nav.
Yeah.
It's what the Pope calls his tom-tom.
Brendan the Navigator.
Yeah.
Peaking early, pal. Peaking early. I went down into the horrifying borehole of the New World Order and the Illuminati, just because I don't think we've talked about it that much. Now, obviously, nowadays, the phrase the New World Order is used by wingnuts on both the right and the left to describe a totalitarian but clandestine world government, which is sort of a pan-national globalist conspiracy state, or something that people are trying to make happen in a horrifying right and left pincer movement.
Stop trying to make New World Order happen, to quote Mean Girls.
The term New World Order was actually coined by Winston Churchill and Woodrow Wilson in the wake of World War One, because obviously in the 1920s, amongst all the cocaine and the partying, there was a lot of governments going, shall we try and not make war happen?
Yeah.
Famously in 1928, there was the real Kellogg-Briand Pact, which isn't as delicious as it sounds, to when international governments tried to abolish and make war illegal. And as you will know, that
fixed everything.
It did. It's gone really well. But yeah, so this idea of the New World Order just keeps flipping back and forth between right-wing Americans terrified of the Red Scare and extreme left-wingers who think the Bilderberg Group and the Illuminati are going to take over.
I like to imagine it's the Bilderberg Group or a New World Order. And all of those teddy bears you make are bugged. They can just, can hear what you want and then just, you know, advertise at you. That's how it all works.
Yeah, I mean, the Bilderberg Group were originally an extreme gay terrorist group in the 70s. Just build enormous hairy men and send them out into the underground gay scene.
Yeah.
The Illuminati, I didn't realise about this, so they were founded in the 18th century by a gentleman called Adam Weishaupt. He was a Bavarian liberal and secular gentleman who tried to build a secret society to propagate Enlightenment era ideas of free thought, secularism, liberalism, gender equality, and he recruited mainly from German Masonic lodges, and it was basically the reason why the Illuminati have got their reputation for being this terrifying and sinister group is either because they are or because the elector of Bavaria saw them and went, what, rationalism?
Yeah.
Logic? Anti-imperialism? We'll have none of that, thank you very much. And decided to tar them with this awful reputation. But if you want a good, bad good conspiracy theory, you need some Nazis.
Yeah.
And I found, if you want,
that's why we're keeping them round. I say,
if you want to bake a conspiracy theory, you got to break some Nazis.
Like every good chef puts a lot of seasoning, salt and pepper in. Every good conspiracy theorist shove in some Nazis.
Yeah, spicy,
just to fill it out.
So there is an American writer called Jim Mars who claims that former Nazis and sympathisers, rather than running and hiding in South America with the dinosaurs, have been continuing Nazi policies worldwide, especially in the United States. This was a more plausible theory 3 years ago, whereas now it seems to be coming
plausible practice now.
He uses the term Fourth Reich. One of the biggest pieces of evidence he gives is the way that there were, most famously, Operation Paperclip, which brought people like Wernher von Braun, a Nazi, into America, rehabilitated him by putting him on the goddamn Disney Channel, then letting him build, absolutely true, you can look it up, and then be horrified once more about how awful Disney is. And Wernher von Braun was one of the brains behind American intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles. And obviously, as the cult...
Here's one we made earlier.
When Blue Peter made Tracy Island, Wernher von Braun was like, mate, it was 30, 40 years ahead of you. He also claims that the rise in American militarism, imperialism, the spying on its citizens, it is all driven by Nazis behind the scene. My favourite bit of it is that Wernher von Braun and the other Nazis behind the scene worked with people in Area 51 to create Nazi extraterrestrial technology.
This just feels like the ramblings of a child. rather than some, you know, actual measured research that you've done.
thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
You can say that any week we do this podcast. My favourite one is someone who basically punked the conspiracy theorists themselves. There's a gentleman called Leo Taxil. This was the pen name of Marie-Joseph Gabriel Antoine Jogand Pages.
Taxil is easier.
Yeah, it is. And he decided to satirise the Catholic Church's opposition to the Freemasons. He'd already been accused by libel by the Catholic Church for writing a book called The Secret Loves of Pope Pius IX. Great work.
Published by Mills and Boone.
Yeah. Pope Leo XIII published an encyclical called Humanum Genus that basically said humanity was separated into two diverse and opposite parts. One that steadfastly contends for truth and virtue, and the other one that is partisan and evil and full of devilry. And after this, what happened is that Taxil feigned conversion to Roman Catholicism and announced his intention to repair the damage that he had done to the true faith.
Go on, what did he do?
So, he produced a book after his conversion that was a four-volume history of Freemasonry containing apparently eyewitness verifications of Satanism within Freemasonry.
Yes.
He described it in another book called The Devil in the 19th Century, and he included a character who was a descendant of a 17th century alchemist called Thomas Vaughan, and he described encounters with demons, another demon that had a prophecy written on the back of its tail, and my favourite one, which was a demon who played the piano in the shape of a crocodile.
Wait, the piano was in the shape of the crocodile, or the demon was in the shape of a crocodile?
The piano was in the shape of a crocodile. The demon was in the shape of an alligator. It was very confusing.
The elephant was like, no, you're meant to be tinkling my ivories. Yeah.
It's really hard to get beyond that. Basically, he propagated this conspiracy for ages and ages and ages until the Catholic Church came along and they said, it's fantastic that you've gone undercover and done this work for the Catholic Church. At which point, Taxil went, punked, fuck you guys.
There's no, the Freemasons are fine, actually.
Yeah.
And no one will ever believe this.
So he is my choice for the world's best conspiracy theorist, because he did a cheeky old double bluff on the Catholic Church.
The old double bluff, lovely. Which do you want to go for? Do you want to go for the old Catholic bait and switch, or Finland isn't real?
Finland isn't real.
Every day of the week. Good. We'll just make sure to... Just if you take nothing from today's show, guys, just keep telling your friends Finland isn't real.
Yeah.
And piss off your your travel agent buddies.
Yeah.
Next up, we did the world's worst haircut with Paul Sweeney. Our world's worst haircut was the reaction to the ducktail haircut in LA in the 1940s during the Zoot Suit Riots. People saw them as sort of, there was a racist outcry against them because it was heavily associated with Hispanics, and they were thought to be indicative of degradation during the war and all, so people would shave them off and stuff like that.
So I started having a look at this. The oldest representation of a hairstyle, hair braiding, 30,000 years old.
Oh, nice.
On the Venus of Willendorf, that you probably recognise. It's a very famous carving of this extraordinary female figure with enormous buttocks and enormous breasts.
Oh, it's a very
breasts.
Buxom one, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because some people have gone, oh, it's meant to be a really sexy thing, and others have gone, no, it's a celebration of motherhood.
Yes.
Because she's got engorged breasts full of milk.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are lines on her head which are very clearly braiding.
Oh, nice.
And there's a similar one that's 5,000 years younger called the Venus of Brassempwe, which I've, of course, pronounced excellently. I looked into what people in Imperial Rome used for hairstyling. Obviously, I use a bit of Alberto Balsam, which you can buy in all pound stretchers.
I recommend Bubble and Bubble. That's my...
Really?
That's what keeps my curls nice and tight, Ben.
Really, and a bit of matey as well.
A bit of matey, yeah.
But if you lived in Imperial Rome and went to the hairdressers, your hair could be lighted using wood ash, unslaked lime, sodium bicarbonate, or darkened with copper fillings, oak apples, or leeches marinated in wine and vinegar.
As little hair curlers. Did they use piss as well? Because they tend to use piss for all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, if in doubt, piss.
If in doubt, just rub a bit of piss in it.
Yeah.
a little piss pomade for you.
Right at the other end of history, I found out about haircuts in space.
Oh, yeah.
So
that must be tricky.
Exactly right. So what they have to do, you basically only really do like a buzz cut.
Yeah.
But the clippers have to have a little vacuum cleaner attachment. So as you buzz, it sucks them up in there.
They can't go into the machinery and stuff.
Yeah.
Or just float around in your face.
Yeah, I imagine if I went into space, I just constantly looked like I was operating a Van de Graaff generator.
Yes, that's true.
Very, very satisfying. But the two things I looked at, excuse me, the three things I looked at, firstly, the afro.
Nice.
It's a great haircut.
Yeah.
I appreciate, I've spoken to various friends who've got afros, and they suffer from something that I suffer from even more, which is strangers touching your hair.
Yeah.
But it is African hair generally is so different to European hair in texture and how you have to style it. And the history of the afro is fascinating. The first historical record of it is not from Africans. The first thing I could find on the internet was actually from P.T. Barnum, and he advertised... Yeah, it's not a great start, is it?
Oh, no.
But women he called Circassian beauties, and Circassia is in the North Caucasus, so sort of like Middle East, Turkey area. And these women were marketed, for want of a better word, as remarkably exotic creatures. And there's an incredible photograph of a woman from this area with just like enormous, vast swathes of mossy hair. And listen, it's not pretty because obviously it was at that time they were portrayed to Americans as, I guess in one way, afro-haired women that it's all right to fancy.
Yeah.
Almost. It's super grim. And,
in a freak show.
Yeah.
Let's not muck about.
No, but The Greatest Showman suggested that they were...
He's great. He's great. Like racism and wars, P.T. Barnum, not a problem.
But I love the progression of the afro, that it went from this... I mean, it's still sort of a politicised... haircut, bizarre sentence to say, but it went from being this great pariah haircut to, in the 60s and 70s, as civil rights campaigners support, particularly the Black is Beautiful campaign.
Yeah.
Activists like Angela Carter, the actress Pam Grier.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, Jimi Hendrix's afro wasn't... Jimi Hendrix's afro seems something that was more achievable for me, because Jimi's hair is not that afro. But then again, Jimi's a mix of Canadian and British and Native American and Black and all sorts. But Angela Davis's is the afro.
Yeah.
This perfectly... round and spherical.
And Jackson 5, I see them on your list as well. They're, you know, if you want a nice you know, array of afros to admire.
Yeah, well, they're sort of like the Russian doll afro,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's true.
Also, a wee little afro mention for the Hadendo Abeja of Northeast Africa, who are a Somali tribe who used butter and mutton fat,
ooh,
to keep their afro in place.
Tasty.
Yeah, exactly. And weirdly British.
Yes.
So much of this podcast ended up in Japan, and it's not that I don't like Japanese culture, it's that it's so intense.
Mm.
I've been listening to the Hardcore Histories podcast.
Yes, yeah.
And he's doing a show about Japan,
which
we both
heavily recommend. Dan Carlin's Hardcore Histories.
God, enormously. It's,
yeah,
so good. And he adapted a quote that's used for Jewish people, but to Japanese people as well, that says, the Japanese are just like us, only more so.
Yes, yeah.
And so I looked up some stuff about a hacker called the Chon Mage, the Chon Magi. I don't quite know how it's pronounced again, but it's basically the top knot haircut worn by men, but specifically the one used by sumo wrestlers.
You have to train for a long time to be able to do it, don't you?
To be able to be the hairdresser.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Sumo wrestlers who have a particular status wear a rather elaborate form of the top knot called the Icho or the Ginkgo, and in order to and the people who dress their hair are called Tokoyamas, and they are basically specialist hairdressers. And as you said, Barry, there are of course levels of hairdressing.
Of course there are.
There's not a belt that you wear, but you have to train.
Get bigger scissors.
Yeah. Yeah, they start blunt.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the end you've just got a chainsaw.
Yeah.
it's the same guys who do the sumo wrestler's hair, the same guys who do the fugu.
Yes.
But you, like I said, you have to train for upwards of a decade. There are only 50 Tokoyama in the entirety of Japan. Obviously, it is an extremely sought-after role. I sort of feel like the relationship between the Tokoyamas and the sumo wrestlers is the same between those tiny birds who clean the teeth of crocodiles. In, out, done.
Yeah.
But my favourite haircut of all time is called the Polish plait.
Right.
And it's a form of dreadlock. It's got a great name in German, that Weichselsoff. Always fun. And it's basically, it's when dreadlocks form into one enormous dreadlock going all the way down.
Oh, yeah.
And it's almost like your head just becomes this sort of rounded rectangle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it had a huge place in European folklore and healing practices. And there was this idea that the hair would become a catchment area for illness leaving the body. So the idea was that you would let the hair grow and grow and grow, and all the illness would leave the body, and then you'd chop it off.
Oh, right.
And you'd be better.
Great, and look better, presumably.
Yeah,
right? Because you've got really ill hair.
Yeah, and then obviously alchemists and wizards and warlocks would then take that chopped off hair and use it in their potions,
of course,
as well.
Obviously,
yeah. It had another great name, which was in English. It was translated as the elf lock.
Nice.
Yeah. It is even mentioned by a friend of Samuel Johnson's, Hester Thrale, in her book Observations and Reflections Made in the Course of a Journey Through France, Italy, and Germany. Absolutely snappy travelogue,
yeah,
title.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she described one that she encountered that was 4.5 yards long. Yeah.
That's two and a bit people.
Yeah, it's breathtaking. Unsurprisingly, it became quite a controversial thing to have. Even now, the phrase in Polish about having a Polish plait, it's, if you have it, it is suggested that you're not all there. English, you'd call someone sort of hippy-dippy.
Yes.
It's sort of the Polish equivalent of that.
Well, I've only got one candidate for this.
Okay.
That is the hair worn by Princess Leia Organa of the planet Alderaan.
Whoa, going big.
Carrie Fisher, obviously, played Princess Leia magnificently, and in the first film is the one where the hair is really in its iconic status. She refers to them as hairy earphones or the buns of Navarone were ways that Carrie would describe them. She had to be on set at 5 a.m. For her hair to be done. It would take 2 hours. every morning with a lady called Pat McDermott, who was an Irish hairdresser who was tasked with giving her the hairstyle and keep maintaining it throughout the whole process. And she was given the job to find an unusual hairstyle for a 19-year-old intergalactic princess, of course. And so Patch said, basically, "I'm sure they won't make you wear anything you don't like." Which didn't necessarily prove to be true. So she had been given lots of examples of interesting hairstyles from around the world, and Pat would take her through it, and be things that, like, hair that looked like milkmaids would wear them, or from exotic tribes, or for different regions of the world. And they'd go through trying out different hairstyles and then go in and show George Lucas and the producers and the first assistant director and go, "What do you think of this one?" And they'd say, "Nah, don't like it," or "Do like it, what do you think?" And they went through about 6 or 7 of them. And then eventually they settled on the buns on the side of the head. And Carrie was asked by Pat what she thought of this one. And she said, "This isn't a hair do, it's a hair don't." She wasn't impressed. But by that point, she'd rejected several hairstyles, and she was aware that she hadn't lost the 10 pounds of weight that she'd been asked to lose for the film.
Was that by Lucas or by a producer?
I think by George, and I mean, the production team requested it.
I mean,
and as a 19-year-old girl who had only done one film point, she was very young, she was kind of not keen to impress, but she didn't want to get them to fire her because she kept saying no to the different haircuts. So she went in and showed them the hair, and they went, "Yeah, well, that's something. Yeah, what do you think, Carrie?" And Carrie said, "I love it." Great, we'll do that one then. In 2002, George Lucas told Time magazine that actually he wanted to give her a southwestern Pancho Villa woman revolutionary look. The buns are basically from turn of the century Mexico. There's a photo of a woman riding with Pancho Villa wearing the same sort of hairstyle from the early 1900s. The style may be actually older than that, inspired by the squash blossom style of the Hopi tribe, where a Native American tribe from Arizona, and essentially unmarried young girls would wear their hair in this traditional style, which looks like a squash blossom, a flower, on the side of the head. They're slightly more concave, they sort of fold out a little bit like the petals of a flower, and they were made by wrapping the hair around a wooden bow in the middle of them. And actually, Princess Padme in the prequels, in the very first one, first prequel, does wear the same hairstyle, but slightly more elaborate to look like the Hopi style. But I think just because Princess Leia is such a badass character and proves that you can look good while looking ridiculous and fight an empire, I'm going to pick Leia Organa's hair as the world's best hairstyle.
It's very ornate and it's very iconic, and it is worn by one of the greatest characters in all fiction. But does it remove all of your illnesses through your scalp and then can end up in a witch's cauldron?
No, it's true. I think Polish Platt wins.
Yes, mate.
World's Worst Teen Movie we did with Bridie Lee Kennedy, and we picked Get Over It, starring Kirsten Dunst and Sisko and Ben Foster, with a cameo appearance by Carmen Electra. And I've gone for a genre of teen movie. First, I did kind of look at a classic teen movie. I was looking at The Breakfast Club. Obviously, a lot of John Hughes' work is maybe a little more troublesome when we look back at it in retrospect.
Oh, don't worry. If you think your choice is troublesome, just wait till you get to mine.
I think Molly Ringwald wrote an article about it a couple of years ago for The New Yorker, saying that actually there's some of the stuff in the films that she doesn't wishes wasn't there, but also still appreciates them as the groundbreaking, you know, teen-focused art that they were. I did read that The Breakfast Club, the casting was going to be wildly different. Molly Ringwald turned down her role in it originally. She was offered the other female role in it and turned it down. And so they auditioned Robin Wright, who's in House of Cards and the Princess Bride, Jodie Foster, and Laura Dern.
Hang on a minute, sorry, that's all fascinating. Hang on, I just made a connection there. Robin Wright is Princess Buttercup.
Yeah.
Does she then go on? Is she?
She's then House of Cards.
As in Kevin Spacey's wife.
Yeah. Ben is doing the mind blown like symbol, but like without any irony.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that acting's very impressive.
But
when you can go from like a sweet fairy tale princess to beating heart of evil in Washington.
Yeah.
Wow.
They also saw Nick Cage for one of the roles, and John Cusack was cast in it originally before they decided that he wasn't actually threatening enough, and they replaced him with Judd Nelson. The film was made on a $1 million million dollar budget in this old abandoned high school they did up for it, but it made over 50 million, so that's a hell of a return. My favourite sort of type of teen movie is when it's a teen movie inspired by a classic work. So if you remember, Get Over It was inspired by Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
And 10 Things I Hate About You is a retelling of The Taming of the Shrew. Clueless is Jane Austen's Emma. She's All That is a retelling of Pygmalion. Where
I don't even know this, but American Pie is based on Middlemarch.
Yes, of course it is.
Road Trip is based on Pilgrim's Progress.
Absolutely, or the Canterbury Tales.
Yeah.
And my favourite recent teen movie that I actually saw in my 20s, but I still think it's amazing, is Easy A, with Emma Stone. It's based on Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. The original book, The Scarlet Letter, concerns Hester Prynne living in, it's a tale of Puritan America, and she conceives a child out of wedlock, and calls her Pearl, and raises her, and refuses to name the father, and she wears a scarlet letter A on her dress for adulteress. That's the original story. In Easy A, it tells the story of Olive Pendergast, who's played by Emma Stone, and it's Emma Stone's breakout role, who's an ordinary girl who lies about losing her virginity, and then she's the subject of a scandal around the school and ends up having to, she sort of leans into and starts wearing dirty clothes and wearing the red letter A and lying on behalf of her friends who want to seem cool, but she's the sort of tarred with being a slut, even though she's the one helping people lose their virginity in quotation marks.
That's not how losing your virginity works.
I know it isn't. she lies about it.
No, I know, but nevertheless, I mean, when I lost my virginity, I didn't sort of rapidly change what I wore and sort of go around dressing dirty clothes.
Did you not wear a neon sign like I did and make sure everybody knew?
I'm just really thankful.
It's a brilliant film. Again, did really well. It was made on an $8 million budget, made $75 million worldwide. Emma Stone was really the breakout. Lisa Kudrow's in it, Stanley Tucci. Screenwriter Bert V. Royal wrote all of it by the final 10 pages in about 5 days. And it was,
wow.
It was intended to actually adapt a trio of books. He was going to adapt Cyrano de Bergerac, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the Lost Dickens book, and this, and retell them all in high school setting. And the first script originally had 47 fucks in it, instances of the word fuck, which were all cut to make it a proper actual teen movie they could make some money from. And the running joke in it is Natasha Bedingfield's Pocket Full of Sunshine is constantly played, and she gets a card near the beginning of it, which when you open it, it plays Pocket Full of Sunshine. There's an iconic scene where she keeps opening and closing it and listening to the song and listening to it in the shower. And that was going to be a different song called Olive, because her character's name is Olive, but they changed it to the catchier and more current Bedingfield track. And the film is full of little nods to other teen movies as well. She makes like a shower mohawk when she's doing her hair, like in Ferris Bueller. And it has at the end her boyfriend is shows up on a ride along lawnmower holding a stereo a la at the end of Say Anything, but playing Don't You Forget About Me, which is like Breakfast Club as well. So it's very much a homage to those sort of films, and it's a really clever retelling of a classic book in a way that some teen movies are less successful.
Yes, they are.
And it gave us Emma Stone, who was excellent.
I was about to endorse that as well. I'm an enormous fan of Emma Stone's work. However, let me tell you all the reasons that you are wrong. My teen movie, and bear in mind, no, I'm not going to caveat this, my teen movie is National Lampoon's Animal House.
You're a misogynist dickhead.
Don't forget racist.
And racist, yeah.
It is... I maintain, when I first watched it at an age about 20, my mate Jamie introduced me to it. Barry knows Jamie. It'll be no surprise that he was the man who introduced it to me.
Not at all.
Let me first of all tell you about it if you've not watched it. It was the first National Lampoon movie about two houses, Delta House and Omega House.
Yes.
And essentially, Omega House is full of the worst kind of Republicans, essentially. it's full of jocks and Republicans, chief amongst them Kevin Bacon in his breakout role. And then the Delta House is the party house,
that's right,
headed up by I forget the name of the actor who plays the actual president of the house, but the beating heart of that house is John Belushi as Bluto.
Yes, that's right.
Who in a rather iconic scene, after everything's gone wrong, downs a bottle of Jack Daniels, smashes it on a car, and then goes to the crying lead actor, my advice to you is to start drinking heavily. The climactic scene is set on November the 21st, 1963, the day before Kennedy was shot, and it's deliberately set then because the makers of the film, and I'll come onto them again in a moment, argued that the movie was about the last years of America's innocence.
All right.
Now, anyone with any Native American or African American blood in them might go, this was a country that was never innocent. But if you think the change from 30s, 40s, 50s into the swinging 60s, you do get that feel about it. Mm. And it's got a hell of a cast and a production crew, so yeah. It was written by Harold Ramis and Chris Miller, based on their experiences at their fraternities. The director was John Landis, who went on to make The Blues Brothers, Trading Places, and American Werewolf. The cast, as well as John Belushi, you've got Karen Allen.
Who's in Indiana Jones.
Kevin Bacon, I mentioned before. Eric Stratton, and he plays in it this skinny, innocent freshman called Larry Kroger. He went on to play Mozart in Amadeus.
Yes, that's right.
And became a hotshot producer on Broadway of Spring Awakening and American Idiot. And of course, you've got John Keith Sullivan as the Dean Vernon Werman, that damn right. Dean. And best of all, Donald Sutherland.
Oh, yeah, he's in it as well.
Yeah, Donald Sutherland is the lecturer who seduces Karen Allen away from her boyfriend. Originally, they wanted to have Chevy Chase in it as Otter, who is the other big fat freshman. Bill Murray was going to be Karen Allen's boyfriend.
Yeah.
And Dan Aykroyd as D-Day, who is this Harley Davidson riding anarchist nutcase. But the only one they got from SNL was John Belushi, who would fly out Monday to Wednesday, film this, and then back to New York for SNL.
Wow.
You talk about great grossing. This film was filmed for $2.8 million and grossed an estimated $142 million.
Woo-wee!
Highest grossing comedy of all time until Ghostbusters turned up.
Wow.
And the original script was... Well, we'll talk about how questionable the current one is.
Yeah.
The original one, Ramis wanted to do it, posited what Charles Manson's high school would be like, and he called it Laser Orgy Girls.
That sounds like a bad Google Translate of something really quite innocent.
Of lesbian vampire killers. He said that when they handed in their treatment, which, by the way, was 110 pages for a treatment.
Oh, man.
We went further than I think Universal expected or wanted. I think they were shocked and appalled. Chris's fraternity had virtually been a vomiting cult, and we had a lot of scenes that were almost orgies of vomit. We didn't back off anything.
Ooh.
And here's the thing. On the good side, there are food fights in it. There is a scene where Niedermeyer, who is the head of Omega House, has golf balls aimed at his head until he gets knocked off a horse.
That's right.
There is a scene in it where they try to put Niedermeyer's horse inside the dean's office to annoy him. They let off a gun, the horse has a heart attack and dies. And then the next scene, they're being told off while behind them a workman is sawing the horse's legs off. There is a toga party.
That's right, that's the famous scene. Yeah.
Where famously one of the characters says to his girlfriend, it's not going to be an orgy. And me and my mate Jamie, when we were 18, no, my 19th birthday party was a toga party in my mum and dad's back garden. It rained and we were all wearing togas. We had a barbecue and there's a photograph of me and Jamie over a barbecue in togas with an umbrella trying not to get carbon dioxide poisoning.
Lovely.
My last two favourite things about this. The description of John Belushi's character, who hardly had any dialogue, and he said he based it on when he was young and had to communicate with his grandmother, who spoke very little English. And he and the scriptwriters decided that his character would be a mixture of Harpo Marx and the Cookie Monster.
That's a great, great blend.
Yeah. And my other favourite thing about it was Donald Sutherland, who initially refused to work in it, and he declined the offer of $20,000 plus a percentage of the gross or net income. And then eventually he was offered a day rate of $25,000 or 2% of the gross.
Ooh.
And he took $25,000 a day and lost out on a lot of money.
Yeah.
He was the highest paid member of cast after John Belushi, who received £40,000 a day, and Junior, Niedermeyer's horse, who also received $40,000 a day. yes, it is problematic. There is, there are a couple of the female characters in it. I would say Karen Allen's character is actually a very modern, empowered, independent woman. She really, really is. Mm. On the other side, there is the character who is the mayor's daughter, who is a 15-year-old who pretends to be a 19-year-old so that she can go and party with the frat house. And then she passes out drunk, and Pinto has an angel and devil on his shoulder, and the devil goes, fuck her! Mm-hmm. And the angel goes, no, I'll be very angry with you, Lawrence. And he does admittedly then make a face of, ah, well, I won't fuck her. And the devil looks at him and goes, you homo.
Mm.
Yeah, which, for a number of reasons, doesn't feel great.
Yeah.
The last word I will leave to Roger Ebert, friend of the show. He says, it's anarchic, messy, and filled with energy. It assaults us. Part of the impact comes from its sheer level of manic energy, but the movie is better made and acted than we might at first realise. I agree with that very much. It takes skill to create this sort of comic pitch, and the movie's filled with characters that are sketched a little bit more absorbingly than they had to be, and acted with perception. And also, it's the movie that introduced me to the Kingsman's Louie. And for that reason alone, it blows Emma Stone out of the water.
What, Natasha Bedingfield versus the Kingsman?
This podcast is over. Yeah. Animal House is the greatest teen movie of all time. Case closed.
Next, we did The World's Worst Parasite with Simon Watt, where we talked about the Tasmanian devil facial tumours.
Oh.
Four words you do not want to see in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Ben, why don't you start? What friendly parasites have you found?
So they do exist. And incidentally, of all our podcasts, we should point out, if you listen to that one, episode 19, it is the one with the worst recording quality.
Yeah.
We are going to get Simon back on, I think, to
we
make it
on definitely are, yeah.
So, leeches and maggots, first of all, they are still used in modern medicine, maggots in particular. If you have an infected wound, then hospitals will pop a bunch of maggots on it, wrap them up, and they will eat away the dead flesh, which is gross, but good for you.
We know we have fish eating dead skin off your feet.
Yeah,
you know, that's considered beauty therapy.
Mistletoe? Did you look at this as well?
Mistletoe, yes.
Yeah, so it's toxic to us if eaten, but it can be used in Croatian brandy called Biska.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, and it is also used as fodder for livestock. It feeds many animals as diverse as elk, porcupines, and squirrels.
Yeah. Birds and insects use it for shelter because it grows in clumps on other trees, so you can sort of nest inside it.
Yes, they do. But my selection, because you'd be unsurprised to know, listeners, there was quite a short list of good parasites, is a particular type of parasitoid wasp. It's called the Braconidae.
There's a few parasitoid wasps. There's another one called Icumonidae. Which are linked to the Icumon, which is the enemy of the dragon in ancient Greek mythology.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. But the Braconidae are related to them. They're in the same sort of group.
Yeah. Their sense of smell is so good, they can sense explosives or drugs. They're much easier and safer to train than sniffer dogs. And, of course, if there is an explosive smuggler, sure, let's call terrorists that.
Yeah.
or a drug smuggler. If you think it's them, then you can just go, get him, boys!
They don't sting. They can't sting humans. That's why they're useful as sniffer wasps, because they won't sting their handlers.
Like, sniffer wasps is such a mental thing exist.
They're really cheap. You don't have to buy pedigree chum or anything, because they can just live off a little bit of sugar and water. they're really handy. Can you imagine going to Battersea Wasps home to pick out a few wasps to bring to Heathrow and train them up?
Yeah. Little Jimmy the Wasp here was rejected by his first family. He was bought for Christmas, but no one wanted him afterwards.
Yeah, and then they because they do give dogs medals and things when they retire. So trying to pin a medal on a wasp, just can never fly again.
Oh.
It's too heavy.
Yeah, either that, you can try and knight a wasp. I.W. Sir William the Wasp. Oh, I've cut its flock.
No.
Also, the bees as well can do this. Bees have been shown to detect to 60 different odours, including meth, uranium, and tuberculosis.
Chanel number 6.
So, I'm going to choose them. They're astonishing.
The Braconidae, yeah. I also read about a few little insects. Fleas. If you call someone puce in French, that's the French for flea. It's a term of endearment. So, calling someone a flea isn't necessarily an insult. In fact, in the 1920s, so around the time the phrase the bee's knees appeared for meaning something really good, they also would say the flea's eyebrows. So they had like
the cat's pajamas.
Cat's pajamas. They're all sort of like, but yeah, fleas were considered quite useful little creatures. I did read about the parasitoid wasps as well, but I also read a little bit more about mistletoe, which was going to be my choice.
Okay, go for it.
Obviously, it's very useful for all these animals to live in. In fact, they refer to it as a keystone species. So that's a species that is of disproportionate importance ecologically, that it's used by so many different other species that it helps support them and so on. It would affect so many other animals if it died.
It's definitely dying, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely dying. It's definitely going to go. And but also, maybe a little note, you know, obviously we think of mistletoe as a romantic shrub. Have you ever considered how it might be used in culinary ways by the Greeks and Romans?
What did they do?
They used to use the resin of mistletoe to they'd melt it down, stick it to branches of trees, and when thrushes landed on it, they stuck to the tree so they could then catch them and eat them.
Oh my god!
Yeah, because it's obviously ate lots of interesting birds. I think lark's tongue was a special delicacy in ancient Rome.
Yeah, I can imagine lark's tongue being pretty nice.
Because they have such beautiful singing voices. Adele tongue. That's the real... that's the real one we want to catch.
I think it tastes quite bitter.
A little bit nicotine-y.
Yeah. I've just realised that Roman way of catching... Was it sparrows, you said?
Thrushes.
Of thrushes. That is a plot point in the Twits.
Yeah, it is. It is, isn't it? they get them to land on it. So yeah, well, maybe that's where Roald Dahl was inspired by the use of mistletoe in ancient Rome and Greece. So yeah, I'm going to go with maybe because we both mentioned mistletoe. Would we go with? Should we pick that out as the world's best?
It's got a sort of like because obviously hemp is got a million different uses. Famously, as a tedious stoner will let you know.
Yeah.
I think mistletoe is like a similar sort of parasite. Yeah. It's got many more uses.
It's the day after Valentine's Day. We're feeling romantic. Let's go with mistletoe.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. So, last...
Just sealed with a kiss. Mwah. And then, yeah, our last one was the world's worst wine, wasn't it? With Amelia Singer. We went with your choice of the seagull wine from Greenland.
I don't think I've ever disgusted you and a guest more.
No. We still haven't tracked any down to try it yet. We must do that at some point. I'm going to tell you about the wine that saved a city.
Great.
There's a town called Rothenburg ob der Tauber in Germany. It was a Protestant town, and it was resisting the Holy Roman Emperor's army in 1631. And eventually, he broke down their defences with an army of 60,000 people besieging them on the 30th of October, 1631. This was part of the 30 Years' War.
Mm-hmm.
And the commander of the army was of the Emperor's army was Count von Tilly. And he was a very notoriously bad-tempered man. And because they'd resist him for so long, he wanted to destroy the town and execute the mayor and the council. They wanted to take over the town to board the army for the winter. And because they'd been delayed for so long, he was like, fuck these guys, we're going to mess up the town, kill all, the entire town council. And they hit in a brainwave, the town council. They got together and they offered the Count von Tilly a 3.25-litre tankard of wine as a welcome gift.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 3 and a bit milk cartons worth of wine. And he tasted it, and he thought it was actually quite nice, and it sort of mellowed him a little bit. And then he had got a little tipsy and said, actually, if any of you guys have the courage and the condition to drink this all in one draft, then you and the town will be spared. So basically went chug, chug, chug. And the mayor of the town, Mayor George Nush, who was aged 43 at the time, he stepped forward and drank for 10 minutes nonstop, downing the rest of the wine. Took 3 days to recover, but did live. He actually, I mean, this was in 1631. He died in 1668, so he had a good long life afterwards. And obviously, as it's as is implied by that, Tilly's heart was soothed, and he decided to forgive the town for the resistance and left it untouched. Just boarded the army there as he had wanted, and the mayor and the town council were left to live. This is all depicted in Adam Horber's 1881 play Der Meistertrunk. And but according to others,
is that Mr. Elephant?
Yeah, it's a translation of Babar if it was in German.
Babar would absolutely cane a wine drinking.
I can imagine. Yeah. According to other sources, though, that none of this happened. They say it was just that they had to pay an enormous ransom, which is a less interesting story. The army did rinse the town, obviously, while they wintered there, left it in poverty, and 3 years later, unfortunately, the plague struck, which is actually the reason why, if you go to Rothenburg up der Tauber now, it's basically still looks like a 17th century town, because the growth of it was stunted by the army and ensuing plague. Yeah. So it's a very pretty town, but the reasons for that is because they were taken over for a winter.
Wow. So so your choice of the world's worst wine connects to a town that is pretty yet decayed.
Yeah, that's it, very much it.
Yeah, that fits for wine.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I'm going to go with the wine of that saved Rothenburg op der Tauber.
Cool. A couple of quick stories for my main one. I found a fun myth on the origin of wine from Persia. So apparently King Jamshid banished a lady of his harem, and she became despondent and depressed and contemplated suicide. So she went to the king's warehouse and she sought out a jar marked poisoning. She got depressed and went to his warehouse and sought out a jar marked poison, which had the remnants of grapes that had spoiled and were deemed undrinkable. After drinking this fermented...
It's undrinkable!
Yeah. She was like, suddenly I don't want to kill myself anymore, I want a party! And she took a discovery to the king, who was so enamoured with this new drink that he not only accepted her back into his harem, but decreed that all grapes grown in Persepolis would be devoted to winemaking.
Yeah.
So a story that enhances both keeping of women against their will as sex slaves and public drunkenness.
Yeah.
I'm staggered that we haven't found out about this already. Do you know that wine was aboard the Apollo mission to the moon?
No.
Do you know why?
So Michael Collins could drown his sorrows.
The eagle would like to come back up. No, you guys always leave me behind. No, it was so Buzz Aldrin could hold communion on the moon.
Oh,
communion, if you will.
Yeah, that's why he was buzzing.
Communion. I'm very pleased with that. And he basically said that he was a religious man, and he said he was genuinely conflicted about doing this, because he was like, listen, we've come to space on behalf of all mankind.
Yeah.
Now, Christians, Jews, Muslims, animists, agnostics, atheists, but he felt that at the time he wanted to acknowledge the experience of what he'd done, and he wanted to do it by giving thanks to God. Which, even though communion is a bit of a weird, in the words of Eddie Izzard, vampirism and cannibalism wrapped into one ceremony,
yeah.
I get why he wanted to do that. But the difficult thing for NASA is they had to figure out how to take wine on to Apollo 11.
I'd be opted for that and not the bread.
Yeah. There was a gentleman called Charles Borland, and he had to find wine that would stand up to the rigours of space travel. They couldn't put, like, a heavy, clunky bottle on there, because of a...
Well, obviously, the cork, the pressure would
pressed
it, wouldn't it?
And he had to find a wine that wouldn't lose its flavour after repackaging, because there's nothing worse than doing communion on the moon.
Can you imagine he got onto the moon and went, Houston, this wine is corked.
Yeah. It would be even better if you just drunk it and go, Houston, I'll take the bottle. Yeah,
that's one small sup for man, one giant stagger for Aldrin.
In the end, they went for sherry, because it's full...
Buzz Aldrin drank sherry on the moon!
It's like a grandma at Christmas. Yeah, when the public, particularly, you know, there's a lot of temperance and teetotal movement in America, when they found out about this, they rose up apparently in righteous anger, and there was complaints, and I don't know, there were public protests with placards. I love that. Don't take sherry to the moon.
There's probably a law in some US state against it because of this one fucking incident. Well, you know, the moon is made of cheese anyway, so you need wine to go with it. Did he bring some grapes as well? And a bit of quince jelly?
Yeah.
Please tell me this is your choice.
This is not my choice.
Why not? Like, it's so good.
It is so good. Oh, well, I'm tempted to.
Come on, Buzz Aldrin drank wine on the moon. It's the best wine ever.
Well, the reason it's not my choice is because In the end, after these protests, it was decided not to take the sherry to the moon.
Boo!
Because they were worried that it might add to the nausea problems of the astronauts, that it could, that actually, that it also in zero gravity, it, something weird happened to it, released an unpleasant odour.
Right.
It did eventually help out. It didn't go into outer space, but it became part of the Skylab Medical Experiment Altitude Test Programme, which involved locking a bunch of astronauts in a vacuum chamber for 56 days.
Right.
To find a survivor. But instead, he took just fermented grape juice into space, which is safe but more boring.
Yeah.
But what a great story. But my suggestion is going to be from a 2001 research at the University of Bordeaux. And he ran a test on 54 oenology students. Oenology is the study of wine.
Oenology, yeah.
Oenology. I'm going to say oenology.
You can say it, yeah.
O-E-N.
Ting tang la la bing bang.
Ology, which is the study of the cartoons.
Yeah.
Basically, the researcher offered the student two glasses of wine, one red, one white, and after taking a sip, the subjects had to describe the taste of each wine, and they all described different grapes and tannins they could taste in each glass. Here's the thing. They weren't drinking red wine. The researcher had secretly dyed a bottle of white wine red, successfully proving that all wine tasting is a load of absolute bobbins.
Correct.
And listen, I'm very partial to a nice bit of wine, but basically there are two types of wine, which are, yeah, that's absolutely delicious, and that's disgusting, it's Satan's piss.
So I thought you were going to say there's two types of wine, before I drink it and after I drink it.
Pretty much. So as much as I want to say the wine that Buzz Aldrin almost took into space is my favourite, the one that proved that essentially, sorry Amelia if you're listening, but the job of a sommelier is utterly pointless.
Wow, she was one of the nicest guests we've had on.
I know.
Throw that glass of wine in her face.
I am the reason why we can't have nice things on this podcast.
Are we going with that then, and not the wine that saved a city?
Can we just both go with Buzz Aldrin?
Let's go with Buzz Aldrin. Yeah, let's do it. Well, thank you very much for listening to Worst Foot Forward this week and for joining us on a more positive outlook on life.
Yeah, so we're all off to the National Space Centre to get battered on sherry.
Yes. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.